I'm Nick Boros, space industry analyst and founder of Rotoiti Consulting, and I listen to The Cold Star Project.
This show is for entertainment purposes only and is not what is termed professional advice. The Cold Star Project is proudly presented by the Operational Excellence Society. Cold Star Tech is a supporter of the OPEX Society, and Jason Kanigan is a member of its board of advisors. Talk with us at Cold Star Tech to find out what we can achieve together with your Lean Six Sigma or Operational Excellence programs. And check out opexsociety.org to learn more.
I'd also like to remind you to check out the America's Future series, the non-political speaker series on U.S. national security and space and defense. Great discussions. Cold Star Tech is a promotional partner of the America's Future series and vice versa. You can check out their website at americas-fs.org. How does a poli-sci grad get into the space industry? Well, like many of us, sideways. And that's okay, because that's actually the normal way to do it. So Greg Hodgen here is somebody who came out of Georgia State University, got a PhD in poli-sci, and went to work doing all sorts of things, being a teacher and a professor and a lecturer, and got into the United Nations and peacekeeping. And that's a very interesting story. I've learned a lot from Greg just by our offline chats. And then he became something called the CEO of the ZC Institute, which is what we're going to talk about today. And when I think of folks like Rhonda Stevenson, who are good at building consortiums, I put Greg in that group as well. Folks who are doing something unorthodox, and that's what it's going to take, because the venture capital field outside of those who are familiar with space don't understand it. They aren't willing to take the long view. They need a return on their money. And so other methods, such as building a consortium, are necessary. So I was really excited to have Greg on. And then just last week, they got their first funding check cleared for their initial startup capital. So I'm really excited about having Greg on. Greg, welcome.
Let's begin by having you share with us how you got into the space industry, right? This is not normal. So how did this happen?
So it's a good story. It's a funny and a weird story. So it actually involves, like many things do, around pandemics. I was working with a nonprofit that I founded quite some time ago. And we were working with refugees. We were working with refugees all over the world. And we were working with the UN to work on the refugee problem. One of the issues we kept seeing is that, one, there's more refugees because of war and conflict, things like that. But the largest growing set of refugees and internally displaced people or forcibly displaced persons was climate of refugees, people who are fleeing desertification. They're fleeing the fact that that floodplains are flooding now, that sea levels are rising, things like that. And after a while, I was like, maybe, you know, I'm just putting a Band-Aid on a very large problem. Maybe there's another way I can fix it. Now, I didn't have a solution yet, but it was in the back of my head. During the pandemic, because we all had nothing else to do, I decided to go and dive into random stuff to figure out where I want to go, what I want to do, because I was like, you know, I'm kind of getting burnt out with the nonprofit thing. Let me see what else is going on. But I still want to help. I still want to make the world a better place. But I don't think this is the best way to go. It strikes me like it's a dead end. So I started looking up papers, and because I'm a dork and I'm a massive nerd and I'm okay with these words I identify with, and I'm fine with it. I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and I knew that there was a bunch of warp drive literature out there and the technical term is a space time distortion or gravity, gravitic manipulation, for lack of a better term. And there's a lot of this stuff out there, like a lot of that stuff. And it was all theoretical, but during the pandemic, because everyone was at home, because 1994, we didn't have the computers that we have now, because we were running like Pentium 3s or something like that. Now we could actually run real math. We could do some real simulations and calculations. And a lot of people did, and they realized that they need a lot less energy than they thought they did to get the job done, but still need a lot of energy. So I realized, well, if you made it really small, you could actually use it for fusion power. So I kind of got into the space industry from a sideways kind of way. I'm going energy first to space, because to build a warp drive, you need a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And there's really only two power sources, well, three power sources that we know of that will get the job done. One's fission. Too many problems, a lot of radioactivity. Like, we all know the issues with fission. It's great on the planet, but I don't want to send out a reactor like that into space. Mm-hmm. The second one is at matter-antimatter reactions. In fact, that's what our good friend the Enterprise ran on, was matter-antimatter reactions. Matter's plentiful, antimatter's not. It's very difficult to make, and the amount of energy required to make that stuff, it's non-viable for our civilization at this point in time. So the last one's fusion. And I realized that using microscopic space-time distortion technology get us the power that we need to make the bigger bubbles to make the ships that we want. Yeah. So I really kind of fell ass backwards into the space industry when you really think about it. It's really kind of bizarre because I was like, I want to go to space and da-da. Yeah, but there's like 10 years of other stuff first before I can go and do this thing. 10 to 15 years, then we can play with the starships. Then we can play with the fun things. But right now we're much more focused on the energy aspect. Now in space, of course, energy is very important. You're going to need it. You're not burning coal up there. So we still have something to sell and something to give to the space industry immediately, but we have bigger goals in that regard. So yeah, that's kind of how it, happened. It's a weird sideways kind of way.
Yeah. Folks, many ideas have come from science fiction and become reality, right? So this is not something that should be laughed off. There is, you know, a lot of serious, yeah, exactly. Communicators to cell phones, right?
Amazon Alexa, like any voice activated thing, mm-hmm. they literally said, we're trying to make the Star Trek computer. Like right. there's the X Prize for a tricorder in Star mm-hmm. Trek, $10 million, I think it is. And they're on the way. It's science fiction is always ahead of its time. And sometimes mm-hmm. they're wrong, but sometimes it feeds into itself. It becomes this nice Ouroboros where it mm-hmm. eats itself and then becomes a new thing. Absolutely. And that's right. what it's looks right. like happening with this right now. Yeah.
Yeah. So the hard part a lot of the time is the mental picture of what am I trying to create? I know I have the darndest time trying to decide what direction I'm in, what's the end result, what do I want here, right? There's too many good ideas in a way, and we have to chop off pieces of ourselves, it feels like sometimes, in order to go after one thing. And so for you to have picked that fusion and warp power idea there, it's a good thing, and it can't have been easy. So you from talking with you before, I kind of figured out you came up with this vision of creating a sort of technological development consortium rather than trying to do everything yourself. You did decide, well, I guess there's going to be a circus here. I might as well control the circus, be the ringmaster, get them in under my tent. Tell us a little bit about how that vision showed up for you, how you arrived at it. And then what you had to do to start getting other people interested.
So my PhD was in political science. And again, I did a decade and change of work with international development and international aid. And a lot of what you see is organizations, and you see tons mm-hmm. of them. So each organization is a case study. What works and what doesn't. And the best organizations usually have a good top-down structure that's rigid but flexible, and a bottom-up structure that can inform the top-down to kind of course correct as needed. And the best way to usually do that is, ironically enough, you're sitting in the country that started, one of the countries that started in the modern era, which is federalism. For us, we wanted to work with each of these labs because they're each approaching the problem from a different perspective. So they're each kind of going, oh, I want to try this. I want to do this. Each of them alone trying to raise money is not going to work because that means that person's giving them money, and most of them are nonprofits or research universities. You're making all your bets on that one thing. And if you're wrong, you get nothing back. Mm-hmm. Our goal was, just like you said, build a big tent. Now we're all working together, even though we're approaching it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And each of them didn't want to do the corporate stuff. They didn't want to do the raising the money. And they were just wanting to work in the lab. They needed money. And when it comes to nonprofit labs or research labs, the main place to get money is private investors, private donors, or from federal grant money. And that wasn't going to be enough. They're going to need more than that to do something like this. This is not something that you can do with two car batteries and some copper wire from Radio Shack. And for those of you who are younger, Radio Shack was a thing. You can look it up. You can't do that. You're going to need a pretty well-equipped lab. And you're going to need some decent equipment to do that. And that's not $10,000. That's not $100,000. That's going to be, for some of the labs, it's going to be quite a bit more than that. So they need good money. The only way to get that kind of money is private capital. You're going to need some sort of private capital company where people are going to invest in that. So the way that we designed it was, look, you can give money to each of these six labs individually, and then you can create this massive mess of paperwork of who owns what or whatever, or you can give it to us and we'll do it for you. And we will create this consortium of everyone coming in. Even better, as time goes on, let's say I need a high energy physics lab. I need a fluid dynamics lab. Because we have a hub and spoke model, the hub is us. I have a chief science officer. She's going to start adding some people relatively soon. We have the six spoke. We have six labs right now that we're working with, but we can add more if we want to. Mm-hmm. So if I need high energy physics, I can add the lab in. I need fluid dynamics, add another lab in. Now, the problem is with that, of course, now I got to raise money for them too. Mm-hmm. But if it's necessary and we're starting to get traction, adding labs isn't a problem. Even better, when we get to phase two and we start actually going from proof of concept to actually begin working on physical fusion reactors or microfusion reactors, now we're building a feeder system. And now we have now we're going to build our own lab. Yes. But I still want those labs to work because now each of them has people coming in. You've got postdoctorates, you've got PhD students, PhD candidates. They're going to end. They want to go work somewhere that's doing the same thing. That's us. And so now we can kind of keep building a nice deep bench of science, of scientific people, of technical people, of engineers and things like that. Right. So when it comes to what we were doing, a lot of it for me was looking at political history. How do you get the most bang for your buck? A lot of people think that the superpower of humans is our brains, and that's certainly part of it. But really, when you get down to it, the most important superpower for humans is our ability to cooperate and mm-hmm. build large organizations. Give me 100 people with guns and a 100-person army. The 100-person army wins every single time, no question. Anyone who's played any PvP first-person shooter will tell you that. The teams who walk in preformed will shoot you down every single time, no question. That's only five people, right? When you add us together like that, we become a gestalt, we become much more powerful. So organizational, the ability to organize correctly is huge. That's what political science is. So for me, it was about slotting the right people in the right places. And a lot of these people were kind of going, we can chase our money, da-da. Let me do that. Let me take care of the patents. You just stay in the lab. I'll find you money, which is what I'm doing right now. So for me, it was just a natural extension of the skill set that I had created a while ago. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that this is the only way to move forward, because if everyone's doing it individually, the risk is too high for someone to give you money. Now I've de-risked it. Now I've de-risked the technology, and I've de-risked the chances of us failing. Sure, five will fail, but one won't. That's all that matters. All we have to do is show the proof of concept, and you're good to go.
Okay. What did you call this institute?
ZC Institute. And that stands for zero carbon, actually. Mm. It was going to stand for Zefram Cochrane, because he's the guy who invented warp drive in Star Trek. But we went ahead and moved to zero carbon because, again, it's not carbon neutral, it's zero carbon. Fusion is like the nice holy grail, right? So I call it the ZC Institute because it is an institute. The idea is to create this big, massive, just like I said, a large tent. The way you describe it is it's the Manhattan Project meets mm-hmm. Bell Labs. We have a clear objective. I want to go towards this. There's a corridor. There's a bright light that's being warped by space-time or whatever. We don't know yet what exactly it is. We're heading down that road, right? But there's a bunch of doors on the way. And I want to pay the labs to spend 20% of the time unlocking those doors. Because when you're chasing something, and we've all had this before, you're chasing something, you look to the side, and all of a sudden you discover penicillin. Or you discover these random things. Charles Goodyear knocked over sulfur and rubber and invented vulcanized rubber. Like, there's so many accidents and random things that happen in labs. The Big Bang Theory, the background radiation was found because it was bird crap in a receiver. Like, it's so amazing when you look at the history of science, how many random experiments that no one thought would do anything showed this amazing thing that we didn't know. I want to pay them to do that. Scientists, by definition, are naturally curious. Good. Do that. Go nuts. It's going to be in your field. You're going to find wonky stuff. I want you to do that. So the institute, the idea is that, yes, we are research almost like a think tank, but create a profitable business model because we are keeping all the IP and we can license all that out. And just the licensing fee alone for a lot of this stuff, because it's a brand new technology, people knock on our door and bang down our door for this. What's really bizarre is that we don't have a sales and marketing department. We don't need one. If this works out, everyone will know, and everyone will come knocking on the door, and there'll be fist fights to license our stuff out. And I'm fine with that, you know? So that's kind of why I designed it the way I did and why I named it what I did as well.
Okay. I think there'll be a sort of a Bee Gees myth about that Zefram Cochran thing. People will still say 20 years from now it was named for that. So how does the intellectual property work? You've got all these guys with on the spokes, right? And they've signed up and said, okay, yeah, we'll work with you. We'll share our information with you. Mm-hmm. But when you create something or they one of them creates something, who owns the technology? How does this work?
So we're going to own the IP. The MOU that we sign is very boiled down is in exchange for money to run your lab, we will actually do the licensing and IP for you. Mm-hmm. So whenever you discover something, you let us know. We'll our lawyers will work with you. Either we contract that out or be in-house. I'm not sure exactly which way we're going yet. I'll let my CLO handle that.
Yeah.
But the goal is we keep all that IP. So they get the money for that. However, there's an additional sweetener to the pot in that we're giving each of the labs an equal amount of equity. So and that will go to the individual people who are working on the project.
Okay.
The reason for that is that one, the way that most labs usually work is you get money. The company gets all the IP and you get jack. You get nothing. This is an additional sweetener because these people are doing something that no one's done before. In fact, I would say they're boldly going where no one's gone before. And because of that, this is unique human capital. I can't replace them. So I need to treat them very well. And the other part is that by giving them equity, let's say that you, again, you got the six labs. Even if your lab is quote unquote failing, if you're still in, you can still win because if another lab wins, everybody wins. So it incentivizes people to share their knowledge, why they failed and what's going on, right? Even better, this actually helps with corporate international espionage. If the Chinese, who are going to start sniffing around at some point in the near future, come to one of our labs in State X and they knock on the door and there's a graduate student who's you know doing the work and it's like, hey, listen, give you $1 million for that flash drive with the data on it. If they have equity in the company, there's a strong incentive to be like, no, this is worth far more than that. No, I can't do that. I cannot stop corporate espionage. I cannot stop international espionage. But I can incentivize the people who are working with us to decrease the odds of that happening. In fact, that's why my COO is actually a cyber terrorism expert. He is going to be designing our security systems, our cyber system specifically to make sure that we can decrease, again, not zero, but decrease the odds of someone doing that. So when it comes to IP, that is our main bread and butter. I can't make this run unless I own the IP. But in exchange, I'm giving them generous terms for that because I don't want people to get screwed over. I was in grad school myself and I got hosed. I didn't get paid a lot. Tuition is great. Getting free tuition is great. That is not rent. Yeah. And I want to make sure they're taken care of. Because you don't know where they're going to be in 10 years. And honestly, if you treat people poorly, especially in this, if one person leaves, that's 5 years of human capital I will never get back. They can write down everything, but their brains, only their brains understand what they're doing right now, right? This is a new tech. You got to treat them. So that's why we kind of designed it that way. So when they create something, we're going to own it. We might need to cut some specific deals. My goal would be to actually make sure that they at least own a small portion of it, but I haven't talked to my legal people about it yet, and I don't want to spitball too much. But the goal here is not to screw anybody over. The goal is to be generous, because if this works out correctly, we can afford to be very generous indeed, which is the whole point. When you're basically creating a Kardashev one civilization, you're changing society and our civilization as a whole, you can afford to be generous. Because if you're stingy about it, there's going to be a bullet in the back of my head. So that's why we designed it this way. And again, if you're in the lab, why should you worry about the legal stuff? Let us do it. Let us do it so that you can spend all your time worrying about this. We'll take care of everything else. Mm-hmm. My goal is to make everyone else's job as easy as possible.
Okay. How are they reporting? How often are they reporting?
So that's up to the, so actually it's funny. We actually have biweekly meetings on Zoom right now. Okay. We're probably going to fly them in for a conference in the next few months because they all have not, they talked to each other online, but they have not talked to each other in person. And they've all basically, I don't want to say begged, but they kind of begged to be like, I would love to sit down with these people in person. So we're going to kind of lock them in like a conference room for 3 days with like a bunch of whiteboards and a bunch of alcohol and a bunch of weed. I didn't say that. No, I don't care. And the goal is to put them in there for 3 days and be like, look, go. I'm not going to interfere. My job is done. I have put you all in the same room. I don't need to facilitate. You're all adults. Mm-hmm. And you all know this better than I do. Do your thing. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be reporting like that when, as they go on. The goal is that when they finish an experiment, they're going to come back and say, hey, listen, what's going on? That's going to usually be about monthly is what it's going to be looking like. So about every month, they're going to be like, no progress, no progress. That's fine. Now, what we're going to do is that part of the science team's job is going to be that they're going to actually be visiting the labs every once in a while to see what's going on. Not to be like, did you spit? You know, why are you buying 2-ply toilet paper? It's not like that at all. It's much more like, hey, listen, do you need more resources? What do you need? How can we help you? You know, X lab has a spare. Why? Do you need that? Because it sounds like you might like, the goal is to save money for everybody and to facilitate sharing and swapping resources.
Yeah.
But also making sure that, you know, people aren't blowing it on cocaine and strippers, because that's bad. I've been told.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I've seen this, yeah, before with similarly aligned organizations that still feel separate, and then them doubling up, tripling up on assets that if they could share it, they really only need one, right?
Right.
And, right. And it can be much more cost effective. And I've also found situations where somebody had something that would have been valuable for everyone else, but nobody knew about it until I came
right.
poking around. And therefore, right. it does not exist.
Right, right. And even better, yeah.
the organization that owns it. It doesn't
right. exist. Well, even better, it's not just the physical aspect. It's also the intellectual mm-hmm. aspect. That's why we'll put them in the same room. Because that the random technique that you just used to create high voltage is exactly what Lab 2 needs to do their mm-hmm. job. But they didn't know it existed. They didn't know you could do that with this thing. Like, they didn't know they needed this compound that's available at Home Depot for $20. Like, that's the other key too, is that they've each been messing around with electricity and magnetism, all these other stuff. They don't have their expertises. Everyone else is proficient with them, but they're the experts. So now all of a sudden they're saying, oh, we have this, we have that, and so on and so forth. Now you're sharing the intellectual needs
yeah.
and the fact that, well, did you set it up? It shouldn't be a 60 degree angle. It should be 45 degrees. Did you try that? Oh, I didn't. That just saves me 2 months. Like, we're thinking when they sit down in person, they're probably going to cut 6 months off of their time in the lab, because now they're kind of cut through all the crap and they're really kind of figuring out what they want to do and where they want to go. So, yeah, it is very much going to be a lot of documentation of who has what, who needs what, but these labs are not in the same states. That's why it's much more going to be an intellectual thing. Like, I can't move the particle accelerator from X to Y. Like, that's just not going to be a good mm-hmm. idea. But they could say, hey, listen, could you run this experiment? Here's the recipe.
Okay.
With this one, you know? So the goal is to engage in certainly equipment sharing, but it's not going to be like physically moving it. It's going to be like, let's go ahead and do the experiment and see where you're going. But more importantly, it's sharing, because right now they're sharing academic papers, they're sharing their math, they're sharing those things. That's the important part right now is, did you check? Because all the labs right now are checking each other's math, because they all think they're right, and they might all be right, but they might not. And mm-hmm. we all know that when you're in the lab, you can fool yourself without a problem, right? So now they're trying to really kind of get other people who are in the field, who understand what you're trying to do, check their own math to make sure that they're not totally wacko or off, which is also really important. Because if they are off, why are you off? Whatever. Go back to the drawing board. Good. Better than you wasting 6 months in the lab chasing a dead end right. because it doesn't work. Fine with me. That's how it's going to work.
Okay. So, Greg, where does the money come from? Who is the ideal investor in this situation? What's their motivation? You know, are they in it for the dream? Are they in it to say, ooh, I have a cool space investment in my portfolio? And dollar amount ranges, what does that look like? And then how long of a turnaround does it look like? This doesn't sound like it's going to be a typical venture capital play with an exit in 8 years or even 12 years maybe or something like that.
We could get lucky and exit in 10 years possibly, yeah. but that's probably not going to happen. And it's funny you ask that, because we just had two possible investors knocking our door. One is talking about 50,000, one's talking about 100,000, which mm-hmm. is great. I need 50 million for phase one, but it's a start.
yeah.
The thing is that what we're looking for right now, especially, is angel investors who understand that if you're in, you're in. This is a long haul. Mm-hmm. You will not be getting money back anytime soon. You might not get it back at all. And I make it very clear up front. Look, this might not work. We know it's theoretically possible. We might not have the technological and engineering and mechanical capabilities to do it in a lab yet. We might need superconductors or something cool like that. We don't know yet. Yeah. We're going to try for 7 years. If by that point we don't have proof of concept, we're going to seriously reevaluate, but we can probably do it in 3 to 5. So most venture capital companies are like, oh, I need my money back in 24 months. Why are we talking?
yeah.
Like, there's no point, right? the way that I'm talking to a lot of people is I need people who are crazy, but not crazy, crazy. I need people who are in it for the dream and for the vision, right? But a lot of people are in it for the kids. They're like, I won't see this, but I want to hold on to this equity because we're raising it with safes, by the way, because what's our valuation? God only knows. I want my kids to live on a planet that hasn't been destroyed by climate change because this is our best shot to fix climate change. If we get fusion working, no carbon, and I can use water, are you kidding me? We just fixed a vast majority of the problems with respect to climate change. They're like, I won't see it. I won't see the money from it, but I can put my kids' college funds. They'll have the money, and they'll have a cleaner planet, and they might not be on the planet if it all works out well, right? So yeah. It's people who are strongly believing in the vision, but also going, not just this is a wacko vision, but you have a viable path to get there, right? I think I told you this last time about the underpants gnomes. You know, the fact that you've got the, you know, step one, collect underpants. Mm-hmm. Step two, there's a question mark. Step three, profit. Yeah. Our step two, we have a step two. Like there is a way to move forward. Before us, there was no way to move off the planet without rockets, and rockets are a dead end, as everybody knows. The rocket equation is stupid and everyone hates it. This gets around that. We can cheat. We can give humanity the stars and fix a lot of the problems of the late 20th century capitalism. People want to do that. They want to feel good about themselves. So they want, yes, they get to say, look at the cool space portfolio, but almost everyone that I'm talking to right now is not going, oh, this is cool. I want to be a part of it because it's cool. They're going, I believe in this and we need it. This is necessary. Mm-hmm. If fusion has been around for they've been trying to make it work for 40 plus years, it hasn't been working. We've got to try something different. And that's a lot of what I'm getting right now. What I love is a billionaire who's not Elon Musk show up at my door and be like, I'd like to fund you. You know, that'd be great. And honestly, I think there's someone out there or a few people out there who have that kind of cash who would want to fund me. They just don't know it yet. Now that we're starting to get a couple of tranches of cash coming in, now I get to say we already have investors because, as I'm sure you know, one of the big issues, of course, is the first mover. Running a nonprofit, you'll appreciate this joke. The joke is the first $10,000 to raise is almost impossible. The next 10 million is a joke.
Yeah.
Once someone buys in,
yeah, it's confidence. Yeah.
It's just boom, right? And now that we have two people seriously scratching or two sets of people scratching at the door, it's going to open up a lot more things for us. Because yes, 50 and 100K is for us, that's a lot of money because we have no money right now, but that's a lot of money for us right now. But that's not what really, you know, we need a lot more. But that small seed money is going to exponentially grow because people are going to go, oh my God, absolutely. Let's start throwing money in. We got to make this happen. That's when it comes to where the money's coming from and who my ideal investor is, that's who it is, really. And there's a lot of them out there. And they're starting to reach out and they're starting to knock on the door. And I'm glad that I stuck with it because just with like any startup, if you're a founder and you don't wake up one morning going, am I crazy? Is this stupid? You're probably not doing the right thing. And I woke up like that a lot. Like I was burning credit cards. I was burning money. I was borrowing from friends. I'm like, I just need another month. And they're like, now all my friends to their credit were like, no, buckle in, we're in, you know, which is great. But I was questioning myself. And you know, like, is this really crazy? Like, is this crazy or is this like really crazy? Like, am I going to be dead in a ditch in 6 months from alcohol poisoning or from heroin or whatever drug I decided to choose, just dull the pain. And my staff helped me, my friends helped me, but most importantly, I kind of was like, look, if there's a 1% chance this works, isn't that worth getting up in the morning for? And every morning, I struggled with it sometimes when I'm looking in the mirror, but every morning I go, look, even if it's 1% chance, you got to do it. Mm-hmm. No one else is doing it. You got to try. Yeah. So and
certainly not this way. Folks, yeah. I'm going to take an aside here. If you followed the show for a while, you know that season 3 of the Cold Star Project was when I started talking to people, and I'll probably put this episode in that series. Venture capitalists who funded space companies. And it's a pretty interesting niche. And I get calls every month from out of sector venture capitalists calling me up going, have you heard of this momentous company or whatever? And asking me about it. And they don't know much about space companies. And they kind of treat them like weird regular companies. So there's that side, the investor side that I learned. Then there's the sort of creator side or the business founder side. And early on in this show, in like 2019, 2020, I was meeting people and I pretty much let anybody on this show who showed up because I needed to learn. And that's the purpose of this show, right? Is for me to talk to people and learn. And there's a spillover effect in doing that if everybody else gets to learn with me. But what I learned along the way was I got discernment to find out who was real and who wasn't. So I won't just let anybody on the show anymore. And so this is a big check mark for Greg, although he probably doesn't care about my opinion. And I like that a lot. But for you listening, okay, again, I have discernment. I know what is a pipe dream and what isn't, and what it takes to build a real business. And you need this strong vision. You need an interesting organization that works in this industry, because this industry is a little weird, right? It's not like fintech where people are comfortable throwing billions of dollars at it. It's this thing where, well, we'll give you a little bit of money and maybe see how it goes, right? Oh, and we want our money back pretty quick. But at least they're starting to understand that it's going to take longer, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to have this really good vision. You have to get your PhDs organized. And then it's like herding cats. And so when I talked to Greg, I discovered here's a guy with a lot of energy. But in addition, I had talked to a couple of the people who run the labs that are now working with you, okay, 2-3 years ago. I talked to those people before. So it wasn't like you came out of the blue with no assets or anything like that. And the biggest thing that I get from you is that you understand something that a lot of space founders don't. There has to be a customer, right? I had so many calls with startup founders in the space industry, and we get to a point where I'd say, you know, you need a customer, right? Who's your customer? And they would write it down as a note in their notebook. Jason says, get a customer. Your app or your technology that you're creating needs to have an application. Well, this one is enormous. The use case for it is endless. We need power in space. We need power everywhere. Cheap power makes life better for everyone. That's just a given. And
yeah.
And it's one of those elements that we need to have an orbital construction facility, right? We can't do it without it. And replacing rockets would be cool. And then just the energy needed to transform materials from one form to another, one shape to another, right? And turn them into something as a tool for us is a huge requirement. So that's why we're talking, because the energy, the faith, the focus, the image, the way that you're organizing people, the fact that you know that you need a customer and that's always present in your mind, right? And then when things are crazy and off course, you almost go crazy because you know, right? I gotta hold all this stuff in. I see it and my discernment says, yeah, here we have a winner. Whether you succeed or not, I don't know. But the elements of winning big are here, and I can see it. And that's why you have the platform, little platform to talk on today. Yeah.
And Jason, I really appreciate that. You know, you say your opinion doesn't matter, but it does, because people do listen to you. You do have some influence, and I do appreciate that. But I'm going to tell you this. Yes, it is hurting cats, but I'm telling you, man, after years at the UN, scientists are a joke.
Right, right.
It's so,
let's talk
like,
about
and
that for a minute too. Yeah,
sure.
Is your background in that area, because folks aren't going to know it unless we talk.
Yeah, so I actually worked. I didn't work for the UN. I worked with the UN. With my nonprofit, I worked with the UN. I actually worked with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. In fact, here's my badge. There it is. This is my Geneva badge. That's where UNHCR actually is. And we actually got language into the 2019 Global Compact for Refugees. And my PhD is in political science. My PhD, I actually studied state capacity building. What's a corporation? It's just a private state. So for me, this is like building it's like me being the prime minister or being the president and building in my cabinet. Mm-hmm. Is basically what I'm doing. And for me, it's a joke. For me, it's so simple. I can do it in my sleep. I did not realize until about a year or so ago that this is considered a skill set. Mm. Because for me, I'm just like, well, of course you do the X, Y, and Z. Why would you do otherwise? Because people's egos get in the way, and because nepotism gets in the way, and because corruption gets in the way, and because someone talks a good game, but they're actually full of crap, and you put them in the slot that you shouldn't have put them in, and then you don't fire them, right? Or you don't get rid of them. The number of fights that broke out at the UN over China getting pissy because someone said the word Taiwan. Like, literally, they would stop people from, like, they would stop NGOs from getting their badges because they're like, you have Taiwan on your website on page 15 or whatever, and it's Chinese Taipei. There is no Taiwan. Like, it's that rampant. The seating arrangements would cause fist fights sometimes. I don't want to sit next to country X. How dare you put me next to them? Like, that, all that crap. I come to scientists, what do you need?
A lab and money.
Great, here you go. Like, for me, this is not hurting cats at all. People are like, scientists are difficult. I'm like, no, they're not. They're they're difficult when you try to tell them how to do their jobs. When you give them the resources and the space to do their jobs, they will knock it out of the ballpark because it's about building trust. And a lot of people don't understand that trust is a two-way street. For instance, working with my labs, I've always told them, listen, if I'm wrong, let me know. Tell me where I'm wrong, so on and so forth. I'm gonna work on building trust with you. And they're like, why are you doing that? I have to earn your trust. Trust is not just handed out. It's not given out. It's earned. And to earn it, I have to show that you can trust me repeatedly before you trust me. You're going to want to trust me because I'll tell you what all the labs want. They want money. Of course they do. They want to do their job. Absolutely they want to do their job. I want to help them do their job. But until they got to know me and learned to trust me, until I started backing up what I was saying, like I said, we're doing the online collaborations. They're like, well, why did I sign this document if you have nothing to give me? You said you're going to find these things. You know, what's going on with that? And, you know, are you on the up and up? Are you lying to me? You know, things like that. And I'm being as transparent as possible because transparency really helps with that. But really, this is all political. Doing international politics or doing federal politics or anything like that, political science is the study of how people organize. And a corporation, honestly, is just a 21st century feudal, a fiefdom. That's all it is. When you really think about it. And I don't like that, but right now it's fine. I'm trying to democratize the corporate workspace for the 20% century. We can have that conversation another time. But the goal is empower the people that you're with, and then get out of their way. And because some founders who walk in, because do I have an ego? Yes, of course I do. Have I learned to check it at the door? I damn well better have, or else I would have gotten crushed at the UN. I've gotten crushed in the field a long time ago. If you can't check your ego at the door, you shouldn't be in the chair. It's just that simple. And too many people let their egos kind of say, well, I mean, I know the science better than they do. Dude, you don't have a PhD in physics. Shut up. Like, you just don't do that. Don't be that guy. I know enough. One of my favorite quotes, I know enough to be dangerous. That's all I need. I know enough to know that you're not crazy. That's all I need. Let me give you the resources. Find the best people. Put them in the room. Get them where you want to go. Then get out. I act – really, when it comes to the meetings, I don't tell them what to do or where the conversation's going. I'm a facilitator, moderator. Hey, listen, you've been talking for 5 minutes. I appreciate that, but so-and-so's had their hand up for two. Why don't we go ahead and listen to what they're saying? Like, that's it. And guess what? Facilitating and moderating meetings, that's like 90% of politics. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you run a room? That's all it is. And so for me, it's bizarre. One of the first questions I kept getting a couple years ago, including right when you were talking to the people that you were talking to, was, why the hell would you be in here? You don't know anything. You don't have a science background like that. You don't have a technical background. The answer is I don't need one. I see myself as, because everyone's talking about Oppenheimer, I'm Leslie Groves. I'm in charge of the Manhattan Project. I'm not the scientist. I'm the organizational person. And Leslie Groves was a military man, like my COO is. So like I've already got that. Again, Manhattan Project plus Bell Labs. Let's give you the materials that you need. I'll keep you on course, but not so much to choke you. I'm not going to tell you where to go. I'll give you enough freedom to go where you want to go. But if I need to, I will yank you back a little bit to keep you online. But the thing is, you're chasing the same thing I am. I don't need to yank you back that much. If leadership is done right, you never see it.
We should be in alignment. Yeah.
There you go.
Very good. So how, Greg, will you know when you're quote unquote done?
I'll be dead.
Okay. And when the company is or the institute has created this this power source, does the organizational structure change at that point? Do you license it to a company or other companies to manufacture power plants or what?
So that is a question we will face down the road. Because we've thought about both scenarios. One, we could basically create like a subunit of the corporation that manufactures its own stuff. Issue with that is now I got to deal with supply chain, logistics, that all the other stuff. Like, I got to build another company from scratch that I don't know jack about.
That's my area.
Right. Yeah. And we've had this conversation, right? Now, I would probably hire someone like you to run the company to do that. But that's still a huge investment of time and energy. Mm-hmm. Also, we don't know what the supply chains look like. I don't know what minerals or elements or whatever we're going to need to make this thing work.
Right.
You know, for all I know, it's copper wire and, crossed fingers. Or it could be like 25,000 kilograms of lanthanum. We have no idea, right? Now, if it's a rare supply chain, I'm going to give it to Honda Innovations or to GE or someone like that, because they've already built the logistics chains they're going to need for that.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, we're looking at both options. And once phase one is over and we have proof of concept and we're starting to do the prototype, that's when we're going to decide, because then we're going to be able to figure out unit cost. We're going to be able to figure out materials that are needed, all that stuff. Right now it's too early to say, but we do. But the nice thing about this is that I'm fine with having to use a quantum saying, I'm fine with not collapsing the wave function on that yet. I'm fine with having both options because I don't know. Now, down the road, when we're in the middle of phase two and we're getting close to building that prototype, I got to pull the trigger. Absolutely, I got to open the box and see if there's a dead cat or not. Sure, absolutely. I'll do it right now, though. And that's the other thing. A lot of politics, especially nonprofit work, is one of the axioms of nonprofit work is if you try to save everybody, you're saving nobody.
Mm.
You got a target. If I'm wasting my time thinking about alternate scenarios that are 5 years down the road, I should have it in my mind or more. It should be in my mind, certainly. But if I'm drawing up detailed plans, that's a waste of my time and energy right now. There's no point. You have a general plan. We might be doing X, might be doing Y. So to answer your question, it's both. It is both. Once we do the math and we figure out what's needed, we might do it ourselves. That will probably make us more money. On the flip side, it might be easier for us to just be like, just spawn it off to somebody else. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable with saying I don't know, because who the hell would know? But here's the thing. I do have a plan for both scenarios.
Okay.
And I think that's the important part.
All right. Has there been anything unexpected, and this will be our final question, that has come up or reactions that you've gotten from people that you didn't expect in the journey and putting the group together?
The unexpected thing was it came together so fast.
Mm.
I was shocked at how easy it was to build the coalition and to build the consortium, because so many, like, there's so many labs doing this stuff, and some of them are crazy, like wacko crazy. But a lot of them were like legitimate. They were like, let's go on board. They talked to me. They're like, I like your idea. I like where you're going. I like what's going on. And I don't want to take credit for it. I don't think it was me. I mean, it'd be nice if it was me, but it seemed like it was the right time. A good dash of luck. The pandemic helped. People were kind of sitting at home going, let's do some stuff. It seems that the domino tiles lined up correctly, and we walked up and went like this, and we were able to knock down where we wanted to go. I'm still pleasantly surprised how many people are going, oh no, you're not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought when I did this at the beginning, people were going to call me crazy, and they did. Like they said I was crazy. It was much less than I thought it was going to be. Much, much less. People are giving it much more gravity than I thought they were. I did not realize how – I'm trying to make sure I say this correctly and not piss anybody off. I did not realize how short-term VCs are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a mistake that I made.
Very fair, yeah.
It's a mistake that I made. I chased VCs for 6 months. It's 6 months that I felt that I wasted. But I look at it from another perspective of, look, it's not a failure if you learn something. And the thing I learned is don't chase VCs who have short turnaround times.
Yeah.
If I literally had someone like, if you can give me my money back in 36 months, I'll give you $100K. I'm like, nope, bye. Like, I can't. What? I'm not even going to waste my time with you. And I think for me, realizing that, because when you look at a lot of startups, they're like, chase your VCs and get your cap table ready and so on. I don't have a cap table. I have a valuation. Mm-hmm. I'm raising this all with saves.
It's the wrong model for this right now. Yeah, you don't have mass adoption of something. You know, you're not going to sell a billion hot dogs.
No.
Right?
No.
And, there's no sample of to say, okay, I've done this. I've sold $300,000 worth of this stuff in 3 months. Let's pour fuel on the fire. I know my ad spend and all this stuff. That doesn't apply here.
But that's the thing is that 90% of the founder startup information, like everyone's talking to, like, well, have you done this? Because startup founders, you know, especially right now, especially on LinkedIn or places that you go to, it's fintech and SaaS and software and tech.
Yeah.
It's not deep tech, because deep tech's different. So like, what's your cap table? And, you know, so on and so forth. And we're going to want this much. And I'm like, so I set up the cap table and I'm looking, I'm like, No, this yeah, isn't.
I wouldn't invest in this because it doesn't make sense for venture capital.
Correct. Right. It does not. This doesn't make sense for venture capital. Yeah. So, yeah. But the thing is, there's so much emphasis in the United States, especially on land that VC check, get that VC check, Like angel investors, they're angels. They just don't exist. Like you close your eyes, are gone, or you get sent back in time in Manhattan, whatever, if you're a Doctor Who fan. But it's, for me, I spent 6 months going, I'm trying the SaaS way. I'm trying the fintech way. I'm trying that way. No. Which is why I kind of had those struggles waking up in the morning going, well, am I just crazy?
Right. How is this going to work? It's not with that structure.
Yeah. So me being able to go, okay, you know, the unexpected factor is, so all the stuff I've been told, like 95% of the advice I'm getting is wrong for me.
Yeah.
And that's,
I spent 2 years finding this out myself. Andy Aldrin probably had the biggest influence on me in straightening me out as far as space and defense tech, deep tech, as you just called it, goes.
Yeah.
It has to be different. It
has to be different.
As a commercial. Yeah.
And that's the thing. I'm glad it only took me 6 months to kind of, you know, go, No. But the thing is that whenever I talk to VCs, they're like, listen, I would tell 99% of companies not to do what you're doing, but you're that 1% crazy who is going to have this huge payoff. Like, you're going to do it wonky. You're going to do it weird. And I guess for me, especially, the advice I'd give to people who are listening to the podcast is look at what you're doing. Don't just follow the crowd when it comes to funding and fundraising, because the thing is that every single startup is going to be unique in some way. Don't get me wrong. If you're doing like another food delivery app, you can probably do it the same way. Don't get me wrong. But when it's space, especially, it's a wonky place. It's a weird place. There are people who might want to give you money. Better have your shit together. You're going to be told no a lot. That's okay. It's not you. It's not that you're wrong or anything like that. It's you learning, and that's fine. Take it with a grain of salt, but understand it's your company. It's your idea of where you want to go. And to make it work, you might not need VC. It might be some weird wonky stuff that you never thought about before. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Think, if you're going to go to space, why are you thinking inside the box anyways? You know? And so for me, like, I would say when it comes to, like, you know, what are the unexpected factors? It really is like the vast majority of the advice I've been given since I started really diving into this, until about 6 months ago or so, did not fit at all. Mm-hmm. Did not fit. Not only did it not fit, I was spinning on wheels and getting stressed and pulling my hair out because I was like, what am I doing wrong? Yeah, yeah. What mistakes have I made? Because clearly everyone else is getting funded. Why am I not getting money? And the answer was because they're running a food delivery app and I'm not. And that's not going to fly. You're not going to have this. And working for the nonprofit taught me that as well, like the power of no. Like, look, there's too many strings attached to this. I can't give you what you're asking for. No, I don't want your money. And people kind of blink a lot when you say, I don't want your money.
Right.
No, I don't want your money. Well, I want to give you money, but I need these terms. No, I cannot, because those terms are non-viable for me. Mm-hmm. I cannot meet that. And I'm not going to stress myself out knowing that I can't, that the cap table is impossible for me to fulfill. I'm not going to do that. And honestly, me being 40 kind of helped a little with that, because I'm like, you know what? I'm old enough not to do this dance anymore. I don't have to make everyone happy. I don't have to please everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a no doesn't mean I hate you. It's just, this isn't a good deal. Sorry. Let's walk away. And that's a huge lesson. It took me years. Like, it took me, God, 9 years in the nonprofit to finally be comfortable, be like, no, not going to work. Don't want to hire you. Don't want to work with you. You are not, we are not aligning at all. It's okay to say no. It's okay to say no to money. It's okay to say no to people. It's okay to say no to advice.
Yes. And again, but you have to have some experience to get the discernment to find this out. There are a lot of people who will take investor money at any terms just to get those dollars. And I think they're very foolish to do it. There are things, ratcheting equity payout clauses in some more nefarious, you know, funding agreements, where if you don't create money for them and give them their payback in a certain amount of time, they begin pulling ownership of your company away to them.
It's mafia stuff. Mafia stuff. It's just like, you didn't do it. By the way, you asked for more money on this day, my daughter's wedding day. You know, it's very.
So don't think that it's always nice out there, folks. There are people preying on folks who have never gotten venture capital before, There are agreements that are run by very nice venture capitalists who are fair that just don't make sense. Because when you look at the payback period, for example, of something like this, it's just not going to happen in 4 years or 6 years.
And right? If you don't say no, you have put on cement shoes and right. You are taking a swim in the Atlantic.
Right.
And if you, and I'm sure there's plenty of founders who have done that and they've shot themselves in the head and they didn't realize what they were doing.
Yeah. But because, I got again, funded.
But that, and that's the thing for me, you know, I hate going back to this. I remember very early a VC was like, you know, I see you got a PhD in political science. That doesn't really matter. Your degree doesn't matter. Oh, you don't have any business experience. I'm like, I ran a nonprofit for 14 years. He's like, that's not a business. That doesn't count. That's not really an organization that matters. That's not really a skill set that's helpful here. I'm like, okay, screw you. Yeah. But he was like, you know, that doesn't matter. I'm like, no, the nonprofit taught me a lot because it's easier to get money for this. A nonprofit, I'm like, I need $1 million. What are you doing? I'm helping refugees. What do I get out of it? Happy? You get happy.
Satisfaction.
Here, at least I have the chance of giving you something back, you know? Yeah. And so learning how to be able to say, you know, no, I think that nonprofit experience was insanely useful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because first-time founders are so desperate because they want to prove themselves. They want to show that they're awesome. They want to build the next Uber or whatever. I'm like, I don't care. If this works out, I can eat Uber.
Yeah.
And everybody else too.
So I think good things. I think you've learned a lot. I think you've realized what's important. And I look forward to seeing what happens here. And
me too.
It's going to be an interesting ride, because just like the whole industry from a commercial perspective, you're going from zero to one. You don't have something, and then you will have it. And then once you have it, everybody will be like, of course, we've always had it almost. And they'll lie to themselves, you know, and then suddenly more of what we're seeing in terms of fintech or SaaS will become more regular with mm-hmm. space. But it's going to take 10, 15 years probably to get there. I would hope that it would take less time.
It's a long game.
We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. That's the fun part of being in space. All right, Greg, that was a really great chance for us to both share some opinions that we have. I'm in alignment with you on that from what I've seen and learned myself. How can people get in touch with you? How do you want them getting in touch with you?
Just type my name into Google and okay. You will find me. I'm the first like 10 things. You can find me on LinkedIn find me on LinkedIn or just type in my name in Google. I'm like the top 8 results. It's not a problem. Nice. My name is not John Smith.
Right. Right. Kind of like mine.
Yeah.
There is nice. Apparently one other Jason Gadigan living also in my home area, home province of British Columbia.
There are seven Greg Hodgins in the United States, but the top two are myself. There's a guy who runs like a wakeboarding foundation in North Carolina, and there's a guy who does, I swear to God, radiocarbon dating of archaeological artifacts in Arizona.
Okay.
And we had the same name.
Yeah.
And it's so bizarre because him and I actually have gotten emails meant for each other, which is kind of cool. Right.
Well, great. Well, I appreciate you doing this, Greg. Great conversation. And I hope that our viewers and listeners learn something from it.
Jason, thank you so much for your time and energy. I really appreciate it, too. Thank you so much for the ability, and I'm honored to be on here.
All right, Greg Hodgin, thanks for joining us. I hope you folks listening got a lot of enthusiasm and that spark of desire to do something in the space industry from our chat. There are no limits. And you might be Don Quixote tilting at some windmills for a couple years as you get organized. But if you are focused on building something, you will get there and you will contribute. If you are having trouble with your startup, if you've gotten to a point maybe where you've got flight heritage, but you're just not getting on the buyer's list, right, in the bill of materials of operators who are building things and putting them into orbit, it's time to talk to us at Cold Start Tech. Go to coldstarttech.com and book a time to talk with me, and let's see what we can do to get more user adoption of your proven product. If you've gone through the effort of getting up to those technology readiness levels where everybody knows that you can fly and you're not making the money that you should and shipping the number of units that you know you can, we need to speak. This is Jason Kanigan, the founder of Cold Star Technologies and obviously the host of this show, the Cold Star Project. And I will see you next time. Thanks for listening.